It's time to get back to the Daily Edition with Matt Gurney.
And I click, and I like, measure up, scrutinize, counterfeit, extraordinary life.
Good morning. Thanks for being here with me. Just a reminder, folks, purely as a programming note, I will be here with you tomorrow and the day after, and then I am off yonder, getting out of here, blowing this popsicle stand, etc., etc. I am going on vacation. I have absolutely no plans. Thank God. My entire life is scheduled. You know, when I'm doing these radio shows, it's scheduled to the minute. I got to know when the next break is. I got to know when the news updates are. I got to kind of keep a constantly running tally. Those who know me well know that it is weirdly ironic that I have to work a job that requires my life being scheduled to the minute, because in my personal life, I'm a little more relaxed about those kinds of things. You know, if I tell someone I'm going to be there by 10, yeah, you know, I probably will be, but maybe I walk in at 10:05, and, you know, in my mind, well, it's a 5-minute rounding error. Other people I know are to the moment. You know, if you're not early, you're late. I'm not like that in my personal life. So when I am off the grid for work, I go as just laid back and relaxed as possible. It's the only way to get caught up, I guess, in one way of putting it. So, this show, well, what's left of this show, two more, and then I'm off, and I will be doing nothing. And I will accept no plans, no matter how much my wife tries to get me to do about a billion things over the break. Not this time, Satan. All right. Hey, no, that's not the quote. Not today, Satan, is the quote? Yeah. And besides, my wife's not Satan. She's lovely. Brendan Pugh joining me here, cybersecurity and emerging threats at the R Street Institute. I want to ask you, Brendan, obviously for the record, I just want to repeat that my wife is not Satan. I don't want that rumor getting out there. But right now in the United States, the president recently just signed a pair of bills that did have bipartisan support, and that's not an easy thing to get these days. These bills were aimed at enhancing American cybersecurity. Let me just ask you the big picture question here. What are these bills actually going to mean? Like, what will be, like, it's one thing to propose legislation and sign a bill, but then you actually got to action that into real life. What is the real life impact of these bills going to be?
No, Matt, you're right. And thanks for having me as always. And before I answer, just I'm jealous of your vacation because, you know, not having a schedule is always nice.
Well, you got to fight for it in this household.
Exactly. No, but to your point, you're right. So President Biden signed several bills recently pertaining to cybersecurity, but two within the last week are getting media attention. First is the Federal Rotational Workforce Program Act, which essentially is aimed at allowing federal employees in cyber and IT-related positions to rotate through positions with other federal agencies in the United States to improve their own skill set and also to get exposure to other agencies. And then the second was the State and Local Government Cybersecurity Act, which essentially is aiming to improve coordination between state and local governments with the federal government, specifically the Department of Homeland Security. And as part of that, that's training assistance, sharing threat intelligence between the two, and just overall improving coordination.
I'm all in favor of this. The problem is, and Brendan, call me a cynic, but I mean, one of the concerns I have is that whenever I hear about government agencies talking about improving coordination, I get nervous because, like, I just don't believe it ever happens. I was saying on the show yesterday in a different context, Brendan, that human beings as individuals are way, way better at figuring stuff out than institutions full of human beings are. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just a consequence of scale or a bureaucratic mentality or just, you know, fiefdoms start emerging here. But we, like, the fact that in 2022 we have to be worried about everybody communicating well with each other is just more proof that we are not naturally good at this.
Well, you know, Matt, I agree to a point. You know, I was fortunate to serve in local office as an elected official for about 6 years. And normally I would agree, but I think cyber is an exception because especially local and small agencies, their budgets are so tight. So really, it comes down to, like, in a school district, buying textbooks or improving cybersecurity. And oftentimes it's one or the other. So I think anything that either a state or federal agency can do to assist them would be beneficial, especially if it's avoiding duplication. Like, rather than a local government going out and creating a new program, if the resource is already there at the federal government and that can be used to help them, I think that's a benefit. And secondly, I think it benefits both sides if they share, you know, threat intelligence in terms of what they're seeing with cybersecurity threats and incidents. Local governments may not know that information. And then equally as important, the federal government, if a local government is seeing something, they should know about that as well to help potentially, you know, others across the country.
Is there a quick way to look at this and to assess what it is going to be? You've mentioned the communications part of it here, but in terms of actually shoring up defenses here, were they trying to respond to a particular threat? Like, was there a particular concern that was driving this? Or is this all part of, Brendan, you and I have talked about this before, especially in the era of Russia going a little bit bonkers again, like, is this a sort of a necessary step to raise our overall level of defense preparedness?
So I think it's really both. I mean, the two high-profile incidents that kind of led to a lot of legislation were the Colonial Pipeline attack as well as SolarWinds. That's what put it on a lot of people's radar. But equally as important, there's been a rise in small-scale incidents, especially to smaller and medium-sized businesses and small and medium-sized government. Those attacks have been increasing. So I think that's also one of the drivers for this legislation. And like we've seen numerous, both in Canada as well as the U.S., local and county and state governments have been targets recently, partially because they realize they're easier targets in most cases. They don't have the resources, whether it be staffing or just financial, to have the level of protection that like a large corporation would have. Yes, what they have may not be as sensitive as maybe a huge corporation in some regards, but they still have information that is valuable and potentially to exploit them for, you know, money if it is a ransomware attack.
Let me take a peek at some of those local levels. I actually do find that interesting because you've mentioned that we've had some of these in Canada, and you're absolutely right about that. We've talked about some of them here on the show where school boards are being attacked, like an entire year's worth of student data, including report cards, being locked up and randomized until a ransom is paid. We've seen hospitals or even entire networks of hospital systems being gone after here, locking up the IT infrastructure of a healthcare system that can actually kill people. Like, we have people who are being directly threatened by these kinds of activities. We tend to think most of these things are criminal enterprises. These are criminal organizations and that they're in it for the ransom, right? And a lot of these institutions will have insurance policies and they'll pay whatever the ransom is and they'll get back to normal operations here. We need to worry about all that stuff. I'm all in favor of detailing this here. And Brendan, I hope I'm not part of the problem. Like, I'm not trying to downplay the danger posed by these criminal organizations. But when I think cybersecurity and defense, I'm always thinking about the attack, either from a rogue group or a nation state that is actually targeting our key infrastructure, not scrambling my kid's report card.
Yes. So it definitely depends on the industry. So in the public sector specifically, it's slightly different than other sectors. In there, about, at least for the United States, 80% of the attacks are financially motivated, and about 18% are based on cyber espionage. So there is a financial motivation that's prevalent. And about, you know, just give me, put that in perspective, about 12% of the overall cyber incidents last year were directed at public agencies. So yes, it's not a significant majority, but 12% is an increase over the prior year. And you're right. You shared several scary examples. Give you another one that happened last year was we had a jail facility that lost their camera feeds and their access to their automated locks, all because of an incident. And that's just one example. I mean, perhaps one of the earliest back to when I was serving in a school board, we had one school board that had their entire system go down on the day of a standardized test. So, yes, that's not a huge outcome, but that's a big disruption to a district that now can't administer a required government test, and that's planned for years in advance.
It's actually really interesting. I'd never thought about how weird it must feel to be the corrections guard when you suddenly hear click and all the cells start opening, but that's a thought that's going to fester. Have we made, Brendan, I mean, here's a big question for you, maybe too big, but have we made progress here? Like, even the last 3 or 4 months since the invasion of Ukraine began, you would have a better window into this stuff than I do. Are we stronger and better prepared for this today than we were 5 months ago?
You know, Matt, I think it's hard to say because it is industry dependent. But overall, cyber is more on the forefront of most people's minds. I've just even anecdotally, I've heard more government agencies now being interested in this and asking questions and looking for resources than I ever have before. I think it's because a lot of the media attention was around Russia and what their capabilities were and perhaps what they could even still be. I think a lot of people are fearful of that, even in government. But then, you know, equally as important as it is in the private sector. So it's at the very least, more people are aware of it. And I think more people are asking questions. And I think even to your first point, these two bills, along with the other ones that I've been through, I'm optimistic, even if they make a small improvement, I think it's better than doing nothing. But I am optimistic that they will have an outcome. And if nothing else, they do have a reporting requirement. So it allows at least Congress to see if they were effective. And perhaps as a way to improve them and make them more efficient going forward. Because I'm like you. I don't like making government programs just for the sake of making a program. But if it's efficient, actually has a beneficial outcome, then it's worth it.
Well, yeah. I mean, normally I'm a skeptic that, like, the next government task force will be finally the one that fixes a problem, right? Like, I'm... Let's say I have doubts, but I think overall we have governments for a reason. Like there are things, even me with my weirdo libertarian quirks, like I will go, it's probably good we have a fire department. I'm in favor of having a fire department. I like clean water. Like that's good to have pipes. Cybersecurity is exactly the kind of thing where obviously some degree of the resiliency has to be at the individual or the institutional level, but we're never going to individual responsibility ourselves out of the fundamental danger posed by cyber attacks.
I agree. At the bottom of the line, the federal government can provide every resource known to man, even provide funding. All that will help, but I think it's ultimately down to both an individual as well as the smallest government out there. You may be a town of 500 people with two employees. There is a burden on you, though, to actually take that next step and improve your cyber posture. Because no matter what your organization size is or your budget, there is a threat. Even if you're not targeted and you just happen to be kind of mixed up in a cyber attack that was directed at somebody else, there's a high likelihood that you may be that target. And unfortunately, I think that it's more true than ever. Really, cyber incidents, not only can they happen to everybody, they can really happen at any time. And I always tell people, your mindset should be is, when is the attack going to occur, rather than, is it going to occur? Best case scenario, you never see it then, but at least you're prepared.
Is there, and I'll let you go after this, because I don't want to burn your whole morning, Brandon, but we're always talking about this stuff. We talk about this from the perspective of defense. What about offense here? Are we doing enough to go after the bad guys and ruin their day?
So I think offense comes in a couple ways. The most prevalent will be is what we would do as like a nation. So for instance, has the United States launched an offensive cyber attack against another government, whether it be Russia or anybody? That is the one extreme, and underneath that, that definition is kind of even broad. A lot of people would envision that to be the United States government taking down a foreign nation and having some sort of physical destruction. Yes, is that possible? Of course. But there's a lot that can happen underneath that. And without going into too many specifics, like we did see the federal government acknowledge that there has been all forms of assistance in Ukraine, and a lot of media people read that to believe that included offensive attacks. But then even underneath that, even at a law enforcement level, there's room for the FBI and Department of Justice and then Canada's counterparts to be going after these individuals and doing the investigation and find out precisely who they are and trying to take them offline proactively. Yes, I think there's always going to be a scenario where we're behind the curve to a certain extent, because new groups will always pop up. But I think we need to be taking a concerted approach to take them offline.
I mean, I would, by personal preference, if nothing else, Brandon, I would always rather be on the offense than defense. So that's music to my ears. I know it's complicated in real life, and I know that, well, I mean, it's complicated for a lot of reasons, not the least of which, particularly on a nation state level, we don't want to be making problems worse. We want to be making them better. But I've never found the idea of a purely defensive defense satisfying. I like to go out and strike back. So hopefully we do see some of that. But hey, charity begins at home, and I think security does as well. So everything we can do to get our own defenses up and ready makes sense to me. Brenda, man, thanks for this. Whatever your next vacation is, may it be uneventful and unprogrammed. But in the meantime, thanks for coming on. I do appreciate your time.
Matt, anytime. I always enjoy discussing cyber with you. Have a good day.
You as well. Brendan Pugh here, Cybersecurity and Emerging Threats at the R Street Institute. We're going to take a break. We'll come back in a moment. Our buddy, Brian, totally conflating those words. Our buddy, Brian Lilly, will be joining us in a couple of minutes. And when I start mixing up my words, you know that vacation that's coming up is badly needed. Stay tuned. Daily Edition, Canada Talks.
The Daily Edition will be right back with Matt Gurney on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.